Welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. This is part three of the four episode series entitled Chaos and Cosmos. In the last episode, we talked extensively about the use made of the idea that opposites are mutually dependent by three great ancient process philosophers, namely Heraclitus, Lao Tzu and the Buddha. In this episode, we build on that. Enjoy.
Haha. I've got some kind of more abstruse spin-offs of what we've been talking about this morning here, and it does go into some page two. It goes into some funny territory. But I think I don't suppose we've got time to go through all that, but we'll have a little look at it. And I want the last bit to sort of bring it all back to something practical. Because as much as I like talking, and as much as I'm kind of embroiled in the filthy business of philosophising, which is completely useless and irrelevant to practical life, mostly, perhaps, I always like to bring it to bring it back round, you know, to what's practical and useful and meaningful to the kind of people who come through that door. All right, so a little bit more abstruse stuff before we get to the practical stuff. I want to just get a tiny bit modern about it, I think. I want to talk about interpretation and language in the context of self, no self, suffering, and so on. I want to see if I can put something of this across. So the view I want to put to you is that the world is chaos. Let's just imagine, just take it as an axiom that we're going to work through rather than something you've got to believe. We're just going to entertain the idea for a bit to see where it leads. The world actually is just chaos. It's formless, or it's even disordered. There's no order. And the sense of order that we get comes from us. We project, in a sense, if you like, we project order onto the world. It's the interpreting part of the human interaction with the world that's providing the order. Now, we know that scientific laws work. We know that they work predictively. And there is a great temptation to conclude from that the presuppositions of science are therefore in some way true of the world. But I actually think that's going a bit too far. It's a little bit incautious to take that leap. And all we can really conclude there at that point is that, well, it works. You know, our science kind of works. Yeah. I mean, Newton's laws of motion, that's the stuff they use for sticking a rocket on the moon. Even though 60 years prior to the first landing on the moon, Einstein had come along and said, actually, Newton hadn't got it quite right. Yeah, it's like relativity is an improvement on Newtonian physics. It's an improvement on it. It's more rigorous. It can explain some phenomena that Newtonian physics can't explain. What Newtonian physics does explain and predicts, it predicts very well, but it doesn't get a full picture. So it still works, even though we now know that there are some better descriptions, some better methods. So the fact that scientific laws work is not an objection to what I'm putting to you here, that the world is chaos and we interpret the world in a way that makes it work for us. We are the interpretative partner in that interaction between self and world, which produces experience. And I'm saying this, and it was Nietzsche's view, and it was Kant's view as well, even though Kant had a kind of a different spin on it. And somebody, again, of the stature of David Hume, also thought on the matter of causality, that causality was us. It was a habit of thought. It was a habit of thought on our part that leads us to believe in causality, that things are caused, proceed by cause and effect, that events unfold through cause and effect. As far as Hume could see, that was us. That was us. It was a habit. Because we do see repetitions, we then get into the habit of expecting the repetitions. So I'm not saying, I'm asking you to believe that, I'm asking you just to run with it a bit to see where it goes, because it's interesting. And it is in line with what our friends are saying. In short, what I'm saying is boundaries are made by us. By a boundary I mean, well, this is a boundary. This, the surface of your skin's a boundary, isn't it? The surface of one of those, of one cell. So a blood cell in that little vein there, look. That is a boundary. That cell wall is a boundary. That surface is a boundary. Actually, a word is a boundary. A word provides a boundary. In as much as it provides a means of distinguishing something, clock, from everything else, which is not clock. Mm-hmm. So words is a system of boundaries. Concepts are also systems of boundaries. Concepts like good and evil, and truth and falsehood, and being and non-being, logic and unreason, all these kind of conceptual apparatus, the conceptual apparatus that we use is a system of boundaries. So I'm saying we are responsible for the boundaries. It's the bit that we provide to the scenario of experiencing stuff. Is the boundaries with which we make sense of our experience. And then what I want to say to you is that, well, and we're made as well. We're not artifacts, but we're productions of nature, the world. The world produces us. We're biological creatures, but we're also produced by culture. And we've even noticed that wallahs like Lao Tzu and the Buddha and Heraclitus, who've perhaps tried to kind of take a step back from their native culture, still nevertheless cultural productions, as noble and sagacious as they are. So the words thing, the notion that words provide us with boundaries, our boundary system that we use is tied in with the language that we use, isn't it? This gives us it carves the world up for us into ways that are useful to us. And if a word isn't useful, it dies out. If it's not creating a boundary that we can use in some practical way, it'll just die out. And you can see this. You can see the way that words are providing us with boundaries in the famous story about Eskimos having 25 words for snow. We might have two, one, maybe two. Because they live in a snowy environment, they can distinguish between powdery snow, firm snow, fluffy snow, wet snow, etc. You know, and there's a word for each one because these are distinctions or boundaries that they need to draw for their practical living. So that kind of those phenomena, the phenomena that languages don't translate exactly across each other, because language communities exist in different environments, kind of makes the point that it's us that's doing the boundarying, you know. Just comparative linguistics tells you that we make boundaries. There's another experiment you can do. You can try and, I like this one, you can try and imagine that you're a fly. I mean, how does a fly cut up the world? A fly with two multiple lens eyes, you know, they have the compound eyes that produce thousands of images over 360-degree sphere of perception. So, would we recognise the things that a fly sees, perhaps? Put yourself in the mind of a fly. Because a fly sees things which are of interest to flies. It's not the same things of interest to humans. And if the flies had a language, would his words correlate in any kind of exact way with our words? Well, probably not. You know. So that's a kind of a thought experiment that can kind of put you in mind of thinking, well, the boundaries are us. We're doing the boundary making. That's us doing that. That's our brains doing that. It's the interpretative activity of the organism. It's a part of our organic being, a part of our animal being. We interpret. Nature had an interesting thing to say about this interpretative stuff that's actually very far-reaching for modern philosophy, and I won't go down that track. But he said this interpretative thing that human beings do, whereby we interpret the world, the perceptions from the world, to make sense in order to use, also applies in our inwardness, that the phenomenal realm, the realm of lived experience, is also interpretation. And things like the sense of ego, sense of being an I am, the sense of being somebody, sense of identity, is an interpretation that's going on in this inner world, perhaps you might call it. Yeah. But that's interpreted also. It's not as though by introspecting we escape our interpretative nature, which kind of is a bit slightly in tension with how we might want to read Patanjali or somebody like that. I kind of think that he's right, you know, about that. But also, it seems to me, well, Nietzsche was able to say that. So presumably, one is able to catch a glimpse of the interpretative faculty doing its thing. You can, and I think sometimes, again, artists, because you kind of play on the edge of all that, that you can see it happening. You can see it happening. You can kind of think, actually, yeah, I'm projecting it. I'm producing this. Oh, I'm seeing something there that I can ignore also, especially if you work with big kind of, you know, if you're one of these people that throws a bucket of paint up a canvas and then looks to see what you can see in it.
Yeah.
You can see it happening. You can be aware of that interpretative faculty. And it's partly what I would say, or perhaps not even partly, but wholly why Buddha was going to say anatta. Because he could see the sense of self being produced by acts of interpretation. Yeah. And I mean, that's kind of quite far-reaching for spiritual waters, because what it means is, instead of sitting there and trying with acts of cruelty against yourself to kill your ego, you just realise that it's an interpretation. It's a projection. It's something that your brain is doing to produce a particular boundary, or to emphasise a boundary in the flux of experience, and so we'll count that one as important. Yeah. Now, in this line, I would want to say that I'm repeating myself a little bit here, but I'd say that meditative and similar experiences, in other words, aesthetic experiences, psychedelic experiences, orgasmic experiences, Dionysiac experiences, what they actually do, all of those experiences, they dissolve boundaries. They dissolve them. Or at least they reveal that they're kind of a bit contingent. They're not as solid as we think they are. They actually, and of course, what you see is, you see that they're moving. You know, flux, anicca, impermanence, movement, the flowing nature of reality that Lao Tzu emphasises. Becomes apparent to you. So you say, well, there are some boundaries going on, but they're rather like kind of kaleidoscopic swirlings in the inner world. And meditation, because it's kind of, what it's doing is it's lessening the static so that you can see what's going on. You're not cultivating yourself in this scenario. You're seeing what's going on. And you catch kind of glimpses, of the swirly nature of everything. Which, after all, is just a play of boundaries. It's a play and a dance of boundaries. And that the boundary around you, your identity, is one of those two. And it has this contingent character. Yeah? And it's not the solid thing that you thought it was. So you don't need to be in the business of trying to kill your ego. You just see through it. In meditation, you don't have to kill it. You don't have to do anything about it at all. There's nothing to do with it, but you can see through it. It's possible to see through it. And there's a liberation in that, in seeing its nature. That is the emancipatory insight. Yeah. And you can see that it's an insight that reveals all of these things, you know. It reveals that everything is moving, and therefore that what we think we are isn't what we think we are. Because what we think we are is just an interpretation we've made by emphasising a particular boundary. This is a bit like looking at a Rorschach blot. People know what a Rorschach blot is, don't they? You know, it's psychiatrists, I don't know whether they do it these days, but they used to produce those ink blots whereby you'd splatter some ink on a thing, you fold it like that, and you get this kind of butterfly pattern. And they'd ask you what you see in it. And you'd say, oh, I see a devil with three horns.
I can see a mad axe man.
Yeah, you'd see a mad axe man.
This says something about you.
This is, but somebody like me says, Jim sees a mad axe man, I just see a beautiful garden full of flowers. But the point is, I could say to you, well, come here, Jim, look, there's a rollers, there's a tulip. And you'd say, well, come here, Pete, look, there's the axe. And I'll go, oh, yeah, I see it now.
Yeah.
And that's the position we're in vis-a-vis experience, whether that experience we call it the world, it's outside, or we call it our inwardness inside, which there really is no difference. So we're in this Rorschach condition, is what I sometimes call it, the Rorschach condition of the human being. And what that is, it really is this, written large, you know, this impermanence, or as Heraclitus said, panterai, everything flows, everything flows. Everything's impermanent. Lao Tzu, things flow like water. They're all saying this one thing. And they're saying it because you can see it too. You can see it too, you know. And it becomes about realising the nature of the boundaries that we work with through just seeing, through an act of clear seeing. Clear seeing comes because quiet.
When outside and inside, there's no difference.
Yeah.
What did you mean there?
Sorry. You want me to go off
another time.
Another time we'll do that. Yeah. I mean, it's a convenience to talk like that.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, all we have is we're working with experience, you know. And so I don't want to. Why I said that was not to draw too strong a distinction, because that distinction is swirling like all the others.
Yeah.
Right, between inside and outside, except for the convenience of being able to emphasise something. So, but sometimes we can go into why they're not different. What did I write here? I said, I can't actually, these are my notes, you know, but they kind of come like these little telegrams to myself, you know. So what then of the boundary, which is your skin, yourself, your soul? Anatta, said Prince Buddha, in other words, there is none, there is no self, because this is just one boundary amongst many, one swirling, temporary, impermanent boundary amongst many. For convenience, and for practicality, you, and because you've been brainwashed, you choose that particular boundary to emphasise and call yourself, but there's others. Anatta, said Prince Buddha, no self, in other words. An interpretation, said Nietzsche, because all experience is interpretation. Whether it's inner or outer, it's no matter. The phenomenal field and the world, it's interpretation. This is what we do. This is the activity of the human being. It's interpretation. And then Heraclitus says, fire. Fire, said Heraclitus. What is this boundary asking? Fire. Well, think of a flame, you know. Again, you see, he wasn't just kind of, you know, trying to impress his mates in the pub. He was fired, he was dead serious about that. That being a human being, is a flame. But a flame's not a steady thing, is it? It rises up when there's more fuel, it goes down and goes out, and it flickers the whole, and it's dancing and moving. And it's a beautiful metaphor that captures it precisely. Fire, said Heraclitus. Lao Tzu says, don't get inflated with it. Don't raise it up, because it is only a kind of a contingency. It's only an accident. It's only one little line in the swirl that you've decided to jump out, you know, pick up on and emphasise and attach a value to. Let's use all the time saying, well, that, you know, forget yourself, just get on with what you've got to do. You know, and the more you forget yourself, the more beautific it is. And actually, he's saying the more politically powerful you become, which is kind of a bit strange, because he's about giving advice to rulers and stuff. He said, the sage does nothing, but leaves nothing undone. Yeah. There's no ambition to do something, but out of that lack of ambition, there's this kind of immense kind of focus and practical potency, you know. So if there's no kind of self, or if your self at best is a flame, what then is it? Who then is it that suffers? What is it that's suffering? What is it that suffers? Yeah. Well, if there's nobody there, and at all, there's nobody to suffer. Is it? You know, the question of unsatisfactoriness. Okay, the body will suffer if you stick a sharp object in it, but that actual dukkha, which is this existential unsatisfactoriness, has got nowhere to take hold, because there's nobody to be dissatisfied, in a sense. Yeah. Make sense?
No, maybe it's not very much.
Yeah.
I'll put it then. Who then is it who suffers? What is it in this turbulent world that can be a thing-like subject, conscious of a world of objects, a self to the others, a sufferer of pains, a bearer of will, a perceiver of objects, a doer of deeds, a feeler of emotions? I mean, what I'd want to say to you there is that need to have a doer for every deed, a sufferer for every suffering, a bearer of the will, a point focus that actually the one which operates the will. All of these things are in some ways, efflorescence of language is a term I use here. They flow out of language. We have the type of language that requires that. It's a subject-predicate language. Verbs have pronouns. That, you know, they have actors that operate the verbs. But really, what's happening there is, again, this is inside and outside falls into this as well. You don't actually need a doer for every deed, a feeler of every emotion. That is just the deed. That is just the emotion. Doesn't need one to be doing it, one to be carrying it. That's splitting up. Remember oneness. Oneness means boundary. There are boundaries, there is multiplicity, but it's all contingent. And that we can. And if we're intelligent, you do this. And actually, you can even notice this. You can notice this as well fairly easy, especially when you do art and stuff, in the forgetfulness of art. There's nobody there. There's nobody there. But you could, there's even some part of you can be conscious of that. And what you have then, that is the process itself only. This is process philosophy, you know. Our ancient process philosophers are trying to get over that hurdle of language. Ancient Chinese less so. It's not a subject predicate language. So it kind of escapes a bit. So Lao Tzu was on a bit of a winner given the language he had at his disposal. But Sanskrit and Greek are really quite heavy into reinforce the idea that there is a doer of every deed. But we can orientate ourselves, and meditation exposes this, I would say. Simple, straightforward being with what is can expose to us that there is just the deed, there is just the action. There are only verbs. We want a language with only verbs in it, you know.
Yeah, I think it's like when you learn another language, you learn another frame of thinking, you know, direction to come from.
The boundaries are different. The boundaries are different.
It changes your whole thinking process as soon as you realise that nothing's universal.
Yeah.
And it's a bit of a mind blower as soon as you find that out.
Yeah, and the more distant the language is in the relationship. I mean, you'll get it with French. Even though French is only that far away from you.
Yeah, but it still has, it sends you different.
That's it.
You can't find... Yeah. Equals to.
It's enough. Yeah. It's enough for it to expose that to you. To that.
I think it's an important part.
To a lot of our categories, being an efflorescence of language. Yeah.
I'd be wanting to say. That's why the Hindus and the Greeks had personified gods
more
than,
to be
than the more Chinese, because
I hadn't thought about that, but I think some, there are Chinese myths with the same kind of thing, you know, the gods get personified. I think that is that anthropomorphic projection is just something that's built in, like you know, and a culture has to kind of go down a lot of byways to start throwing it off, and we're still, you know, it's still lingering around after 200 years, 250 years of this culture, which has more or less attempted to throw all that off, and it still hasn't. You know, it's, I think there's something a bit primordial in that tendency. But it's interpretation again. You interpret in the light of what you know. You know, so the gods are like us. It's actually a very it's an easy way of trying to make some kind of sense. But of course, it leads you into the idea that if you sacrifice a goat, the gods might stop tormenting you.
Just what if the Chinese have less of that?
I'm not sort of fantastically knowledgeable about that, but I think they've got the same stuff. To be honest, Lao Tzu's not that bothered. Heraclitus don't seem that bothered. He was tending towards some kind of monotheism, probably. He talks about Zeus and stuff. And the Buddha wasn't that bothered, even though the gods apparently petitioned the Buddha to not to leave just yet, because people need him, you know.
Anyway. All right, so I've got this. Who then is it who suffers? And, you know, who is the doer of the deeds? Who is the perceiver of the objects? Who is the feeler of the emotions? Who is the sufferer of the pains? Who is the self that relates with others which are not self? And I'll put a few things here off, but I've said it is one contained by an imaginary boundary, who has yet to see his imagination in play. It is one imagining stasis when all there is flux. So to be a self, you have to kind of, you have to imagine this stasis thing. You have to kind of freeze things. You have to kind of put a freeze frame on it. Because really what's going on is the film is playing on. You put a freeze frame on it in order to be a self. So, remember, you're brought up to have a self. Your culture inculcates you with a self. And 20 years of schooling makes it more rigid, stamps it in more firmly into your being. But part of that process is that, again, we have to kind of deny the flux. We have to, in our interpretative activity, we have to kind of freeze frame. You stop doing that, or you move back a little bit with it, you turn it down a bit, turn that interpretative stuff down a bit. And what you find that actually the flux is kind of, it's going on at all levels, all periods of time. If you can get your consciousness right down to registering a 40th of a second or something, you still see flux, movement. Similarly, you think the big scale, you know, Big Bang, cosmos, planets condensing out of it. You get the same thing, you know.
All right, and I went down here and I had another thing here. This is what happens when you start writing stuff in the middle of the night. And also, this one who suffers, this one who is the doer of the deeds, and often it is nothing. It is an illusion created by nouns where there should have been verbs. It is that which the subject-less seeing of meditation sees through. So meditation is seeing, but without a subject seeing. And without any objects being seen, it's this holistic process of seeing. Yeah. So the subject and the object are kind of out of the picture. They're dissolved, or those boundaries are dissolved. You know. So we're just at the process of seeing. And in the process of seeing, one of the things that you see through is the idea that you're a fixed thing-like self. This is Buddha's. This is what came to him under the tree, having starved himself for 6 years, you know, and tortured himself for 6 years. Gives up on that, goes and has some cornflakes, sits under the tree, belly stopped rumbling, feeling a bit fitter.
sits under the tree, vows to sit under the tree till he gets it all sorted out, however long it takes, and ba-boom, explosion in the mind. Oh, yeah.
Right. I've got some more in. It is a salt, like a salt bubble. Fascinating but momentary, colourful but insubstantial. It is full of particulars inserted by the world, a creation of the engineering of life in society, a phantasm of thy consciousness. Because another aspect of being a self is that it needs food. You have to feed it. It's like, at some level, we know it's an illusion. We know that the boundaries are dancing and jumping around. We know that. How can anybody not deny that? But we all do. We're all in denial about it. And it keeps yourself going with food. The food you get is off other people. It's the reflection. Mm-hmm. I mean, Jim's looking at me. He's confirming me. Mm-hmm. You're confirming me, boy, and I'm looking at you and I'm confirming you. So the feedback that you get off people, that you seek from people, we actually even seek and manipulate the situation so that they'll give us the feedback that's going to confirm our illusions. What a horrible game that we're all in, of just confirming each other's illusions so we can keep this major illusion going that we're somebody. So that's what I mean by that, thy consciousness. And this is why some people do, they seek isolation. And I'd put it to you that if you went away totally on your own for about, I should think most people a week would do it. It doesn't take very long because it relies, so that boundary relies on a lot of food to maintain itself, and the food comes from other people. And from all the social games that we play, provide the food for us to confirm our identities. You deprive yourself of that food, and it's very, very quick, I've found. Yeah, you know, there's definitely nobody in.
So do you think
very quickly.
That people who really, really struggle having any time on their own and don't want to do that and always need somebody, do you think they're really struggling to let go of their own self or?
Well, the struggling to let go. The struggle is to maintain it in the face of just evidence upon evidence upon evidence,
yeah,
that it isn't, that you're not what you think you are.
Yeah.
That's, especially if that's it's all. A negative self-image.
Yeah.
Then you do kind of crave.
You hang on.
I suppose that's what I mean. You're hanging on to something. You don't want to let go.
Yeah. There's an enormous investment in it, in the idea in Atman rather than Anatol. There's an enormous investment of energy in it. An enormous investment on society's part in creating you like that.
Mm.
Real products of social engineering.
Mm.
Which, in a culture like ours, which is kind of, in the sense, like complex, I nearly said sophisticated, but it's certainly very, very complex. And so it takes, what's the average schooling now in the country? From 5 to 8, 13 years in the education system.
Mm.
Plus the whole thing of learning a language your mother's need, possibly, in our kind of society. Mm. We don't have kibbutzes and stuff, do we? So you get it at your mother's need. And that whole kind of drama of learning a complete language in a couple of years, I mean.
Mm.
This is serious investment in your self-image, not only on your own part, but on society's part. So it doesn't drop away without struggle, but yet without food it's very hard for it to maintain itself. Mm. Some people are going to be better at it than others. You know, if it's kind of a bit flimsy anyway, and you're not too invested in it anyway, two or three days away from everything, and you become very transparent, I think, in that sense. That boundary, it becomes at least porous, if not non-existent. Well, it doesn't exist anyway, but because it's a pattern in it's a fluxing pattern. So.
Some people really, really, really fear that, though, don't they? That just being on their own for a while. And I wonder if it's because of facing themselves, facing what's happened in their lives, you know, and perhaps.
There's a lot of reasons. There's a lot of reasons.
Because for some, it may even be not.
Yeah.
At a particular time, it might not be good for them to do it.
I mean, it might be
emotionally not right for them to do
it. But maintaining that boundary might be. it can be a lot of things, you know, but it might be an act of keeping it by traumatic,
yeah,
traumatic experiences that want to surface.
Yeah.
People think that you have to kind of dig deep to get traumas out. You don't.
No.
You actually don't. You just have to stop.
Yeah.
Stop keeping the lilies on. They want to surface. They want to surface. And Patanjali is very clear about this.
Yeah.
The psychoanalysts were kind of wrong about it. Really, you have to go through all this dredging. It's not, and the effort and the expenditure of any energy goes into keeping the lid on, not to getting the lid off. You know, so there would be a catch. Some people going into solitary for a bit could be disastrous. You know, yeah. It's an immediate thing.
I was just thinking of some of my students, and some of them I would not advise them to do that because I really don't think it would be good for them at all.
Yeah, I mean, all this stuff sources for courses. I'm kind of do presume if you've come through that door, you're kind of a bit up for it, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
There can be a grieving process.
There's all kinds of stuff. There's all kinds of stuff that can happen with that.
Yeah, I think you know, if you've invested in the world, to hear that you are nothing can be quite traumatic in itself.
Yeah.
And then if you're getting confirmations of that, and because it requires another type of strength somewhere,
You're right. You're dead right. I'm not offering it out as any kind of general general panacea at all.
But the beautiful things that happen as a result.
Yeah.
But the sensitivity that comes through is
you're
getting the same level of
blows your mind.
Yeah,
yeah.
What do you mean?
I think there's different levels, but there's different personalities you keep constructing. We're not simply or that.
Mm-hmm.
We've got lots of but I mean, I think they easily dissolve in one go.
Yeah.
You see.
Yeah.
But I think if you drop one, you should put another one in.
Mm. You can do. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, what else did I say about it, Aileen? Just for fun.
Okay,
I've said that it is a skein of stories, ever moving on, like a lightning fast soap opera, or tragic comedy. Mm. It is in itself suffering.
Yeah.
The whole game of having a self is suffering.
Yeah.
But again, people get the wrong end of the stick. They hear stuff like this, and they think, "So I've got to behave like nobody." And the thing is that all the particulars that happen to your organism—that you were born in such and such a place, that your mum was such and such a person, your dad was such and such a person, you had so many brothers and sisters, you went to such and such a school, you had an accident when you were three, which caused you to kind of be frightened of cats, and then you got married, all the contingencies of biography don't go away. In a sense, they've gone away because they're in the past. They don't really exist in the past. But at the same time, you know, we're beings of time. We process time, and the past impresses us and informs our present and our future. That doesn't stop. Some people imagine that seeing through self, seeing through, not losing the self, realizing that you never had it in the first place, doesn't need to produce, it doesn't dissolve all those contingencies that belong to your organism.
Mm.
They're still there. But some people think that they then start acting out this kind of zombie role. And actually, the personality, for all of its contingent nature, actually becomes a little bit exaggerated.
Mm.
You know, strangely, in the loss of self, the personality becomes exaggerated.
Because there's a resistance.
I don't know, it just because there's no resistance, actually. Mm. There's no resistance to it.
Oh,
you see what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, so...
Because they say that when you have an emotion, there are peptides that slot into different types of cells.
Yeah.
So it is a physiological thing
that
when you... And cells reproduce, it stays there.
Yeah.
And ages you. But then obviously if you have different emotions, then that will become the emotional thing that slots into your body that will override the other ones.
Yeah.
So it's not...
So what you're describing there actually is the process. You're describing process. I mean, what this insight is that we're process, not things.
Exactly.
Things in the sense of like objects, like. And we're invested and we're encouraged to be invested in that. But really, what you're saying is what's going on. Is this process with this interaction between the three times, you know, between the past, the present and the future, interacting in an ongoing day and night until this particular organism dies?
Yeah.
You know, so... Awesome. And that is the shift in perspective that's going on here. It's not like you've got to kill your ego or kill your personality or stop expressing yourself in any way that you happen to find yourself expressing yourself. It's none of that. It's seen through that it was never there in the first place and that it's process and a dance and a movement and a flame, a fire, rather than a thing, rather than a being. It's a becoming rather than a being. The being, is when we interpret ourselves as a being rather than a becoming, you can see yourself doing that. And in that, you can realise the contingency of it. You can see that it's a part of the interpretative mechanism. There's no need to worry about that. I mean, what does Nietzsche say about it? He says, you know, we live within an interpretative framework that we can't throw off. I mean, he was of the opinion that cause and effect, a bit like Hume and Kant for that matter, was some kind of a projection that we manufacture. But you can't live a life without presuming that there is cause and effect in the universe. You can't.
No.
You can't function.
I mean, even science.
It might be wrong, but we've got to do it.
Yeah.
You know,
quantum physics even say, realizing that that on that quantum level, you can't predict always what's happening.
Yeah.
There is a relationship between the observed.
I mean, actually, in my notes, it's got, which we didn't go down there, I've got like Heisenberg, and I don't mean Walter White, I mean Heisenberg.
I don't know that.
I mean Heisenberg. Heisenberg, you know, because what did he do? He replaced, what did he do? He cut through the notion that there was an impartial observer.
Mm.
There isn't. Every observer is a participant.
Mm. Absolutely.
Which is what Nietzsche's saying about the... All of this, though, can be derived straight away, and I think Nietzsche was a fan of Heraclitus. You know, he was the only Greek philosopher he rated was Heraclitus. All this can be derived from impermanence or flux, panterai, everything flows, or everything is flowing like water, as our man Lao Tzu says.
So
I'm trying to point to a kind of a seeing through there, you know, that is a meditative possibility. Seeing through, exposing.
Sword.
Yeah. But it doesn't require that you kind of get puritanical or sniffy about anything about yourself.
Mm-hmm. it comes and goes, those boundaries as well, doesn't it? Because I think you can completely let go of them.
Yeah.
If you're going, you know, maybe go on a retreat on your own and drop it. And
what about?
But then something happens in life, perhaps too, that's quite traumatic, and they come back again.
Yeah, you can find,
And then you've got to go kind of through all that.
Yeah. Well, it's a play. It's a play and a dance, swirling lines,
yeah,
you know.
Sort of
in any,
it's a roly-poly, isn't it?
It's a roly-poly.
Yeah, it's a
roly-poly. But I mean, you're saying you can go on retreat, but what happens when you go to sleep, you know?
Yeah.
Nobody has any trouble dropping it at bedtime.
No, that's true, isn't it?
You go right there into the void, you know, and you may never wake up, and you have no trouble. Well, some of you might have some trouble.
But you need the void. With the void, you put your interpretation, you create form then.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
I wasn't saying, that wasn't my point. My point just was just really that we don't have a problem dropping it. You know, we don't have to go through, going on retreat, you know, going away for a bit's great and it does change the game. But nevertheless, But nevertheless, we surrender to it with no problem at night. Is what I'm just saying. It's just the bedtime. We surrender to it. Where's your ego in deep dreamless sleep? You know, it's going to go there into that nothingness.
What about when you have lucid dreams, though? Don't you think your ego comes into it then? Because it might start to become a bit conscious then.
It might.
And you might even think, oh my God,
put on a bit. Yeah, it plays the role of the hero in a drama, doesn't it?
Yeah.
In a dream.
And we're supported in that letting go by our conditioning.
Mm.
In sleep, like.
Yeah, I mean, babies, we help them to go to sleep, don't we, until they learn how to go to sleep.
So we're not fearful of it?
No.
Unless we have people who have crappy dreams all the time.
Yeah, and then, which you might be, you might then be. I'm trying to get at what you're saying there about, it's a bit peripheral.
So we're nothing. So if we're nothing, essentially, I don't know.
It's a bit
use of language, we're space.
Yeah.
Right.
Look, let's talk about figure and ground. Figure and ground. Do you understand?
Yeah.
Have you ever seen that ambiguous picture? It's called a duck rabbit.
Yeah.
Where it looks, it's a picture. It's a picture, and if you look at it, you can see. You see a duck. Just a little simple drawing on it. You see a duck, and then you look at it. And it changes from a duck into a rabbit. It's an it's just the way it's drawn is ambiguous. So you can interpret it as a duck, or you can interpret it as a rabbit.
Like your flowers and axemen.
And or a flower, a bunch of flowers and an axeman. Yeah. We kind of. But the same thing. The thing is both a duck and a rabbit. You know, even though I've probably gone into the wrong example. But even like figure and ground. So I'm going to draw a picture on there of a whatever, an apple.
But you're giving form to the space.
Yeah.
But
I can't. What I'm saying is this is the conjunctio oppositorium. This is the mutual dependence of opposites. The figure and the ground are one. We can't have the figure without the ground. We can't have the ground.
Absolutely.
The ground invites a figure.
Yeah.
You know, and it's the same with like void and form.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
Our friend Nagarjuna, who said Nirvana is samsara. The other thing he said was form is void. Void is form.
Mm.
Actually, the Buddha is reported to have said that in the Heart Sutra. And the Diamond Sutra repeated it as well. And he said form is void. Void is form.
Mm.
In other words, actually, these are not two things. These are two ways of talking. These are two aspects of one of a single thing, which is the figure ground, the picture, the picture. So, this is the conjunction of opposites, basically, and
you're saying like the meditation then.
It exposes that
it
too.
It exposes the construct or
yeah. I think you
the
can
the boundaries that we create.
Yeah, you can see yourself creating them. You know, or
dissipates.
Yeah.
The other things happen.
Or allows you to or there is some kind of when I say you here, of course I'm on a trick sticky wicket, but this is language. You know, it enables you to play with them. It's what I'm doing here now. I'm playing. You ask me what I'm doing. I'm playing, man. It might seem a bit serious, you know, playing with the boundaries and the forms and in the realm, in this realm, and in the realm, and in this realm, and this kind of relatedness, just playing with it.
So what you were
because
saying,
it's live oil, it's live oil, it's mobile, it's free moving, it's not fixed. All of our problems, all of our dukkha, is because we make it fixed and it doesn't want to be. It's struggling to keep dancing.
It's the opposite. It's the opposite.
What's that?
Get rid of dukkha and you've got ananda.
Yeah.
What's ananda?
Joy.
Dukkha or sukha. It's dukkha and sukha it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Dukkha, bad axle hole. Sukha, good axle hole. Plenty of grease, basically. Plenty of lubrication.
Okay.
Jim.
Yeah. Yeah, but any feel good.
I mean, people talk about from chaos. Chaos comes creativity.
Yeah.
And I think artists
that's wrong, yeah.
know a lot about that. Sometimes you're in the middle of some work, and it does feel chaotic.
Mm-hmm.
And you sort of like, but that's it's almost like burning down the piece of work that you're doing. But something creative comes out of that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, what I want for part four of the thing, part three. Sorry, part one. Part one is all the stuff about one, two, and three. Part two about interpretation and language. Part three, creativity and practicality.
Okay.
What I'd be wanting to say there, because it's nearly 4:05 now. But what I wanted to say there is that the void is pregnant.
Yeah.
The void is pregnant.
It is.
The chaos is pregnant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we destabilise all the boundaries and shake everything up so it'll reform. As artists, we artists do it on purpose, man, because we like it, because it's actually it's a Dionysian kind of overflowing, and it's nice.
And the boundaries between chaos and creativity are quite blurred as well, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean those boundaries are blurred as well. Yeah. Anyway, and they're mutually dependent. Chaos and cosmos are mutually dependent. They're opposites. All opposites are mutually dependent. So chaos and cosmos are just two aspects of one thing.
Mm.
But it's a process, it's not a thing, it's a process.
Yes, yeah.
It's so refreshing for the limitations of the stagnant mind that is trying to grasp.
Yeah.
And the creativity
blows it open.
There's a freshness, and then that order can be revised.
Yeah.
And become more intelligent.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
That's it, you got it. Bang on. Right.